Appreciate that. It's been a real fun weekend, as far as I'm concerned, and Peg too. We both remarked. The Scotts are, John and Cindy are especially good friends of ours, and have been for many years. And it was good to spend time with them, and we love them both. And Scott Benz also spoke here this weekend, spoke on Friday night, as you all know. And Scott made a very good AA talk, and as the other talks were, my wife last night got certainly carried away with herself, and made an excellent talk, and you know, I think that you all are very fortunate up to this point in the weekend. You've certainly had some great examples, and these are great people who are very active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're doing what's necessary to be done to stay sober and to help others. And that's what we're supposed to be doing. I think that I know what God's will is for me, and I believe I know what it is for you. And I believe that God's will for me is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And I don't think it's any more complicated than that. I think it's just that simple. There are many parts to that, of course. But basically what it amounts to is that we're just going to go forward and try to do what we can to stay sober ourselves, do what's necessary to do. Everyone talked about meetings and attending meetings and how necessary that was for them to stay sober and stay comfortable and not get restless and irritable and discontent just because that goes on. We said the serenity prayer this morning, and as usual, the serenity prayer was misquoted. I want you to know that, and I want to tell you right now so you can straighten it up. It isn't the wisdom to know the difference. It is just wisdom to know the difference. There is no "the" in there. So I wish you all would shape up and get that straightened out. Aside from that, it was perfect. I used to drink a lot. I started drinking when I was a kid, about 14 years old, and I drank at every opportunity I could. I started having blackouts by the time I was 17. It was the first one I recall, and that I had. I don't know what happened, but I remember I didn't remember any of it. And like everyone else, I was concerned about it. I was concerned whether I'd driven home, and if so, what kind of shape the car was in, and so on and so forth. And I was amazed that the car was in good shape and wasn't hurt or harmed, and no fender benders or anything like that. And I just kind of figured it, well, I just didn't remember it, and that's the way that's going to be, and I never worried about it afterwards. Except every now and then somebody'd bring up something that I'd done when I was drinking that I didn't recall. And I don't know why I should get excited about it, but I just kind of ignored them, and because I believe that they were exaggerating the circumstances. I was arrested 23 times for public intoxication. I used to drink in the Town and Country Bar in the Mayflower Hotel in downtown Washington, D.C., and a lot of senators and congressmen and important people had apartments there where they stayed. And I used to think it made me feel important to be in the same room with them and act as if I was one of them. I did a lot of acting. I remember occasionally, each quarter of the year, I'd get a commission check. I was a salesman. And I got a commission check, and I would go to this, what I believed to be a fabulous French restaurant, and order drinks and wine all by myself. And I would sit there, and I would make sure that I was well-dressed and as handsome as I could be. And I would sit there and pretend that I was somebody else. And it was That was a great thing. It was a lot of fun. Thank you, John. Is that better?
Oh, yeah.
But as I say, I pretended a lot of things. And I pretended that I wasn't the drunk that I was. And I pretended that I was better educated than I was. And I pretended that I was wealthier than I was. And just all of those things. I just, my life itself was an act. And I didn't object to that. I don't know why it was that people had some sort of an idea that I was wealthy. I mean, when I was going to college, for an example, I went to a sidewalk college and George Washington University and Maryland University and Maryland Extension School and Southeastern University, and I managed to accrue 160 credit hours, and I don't even have an associate's degree. But I was busy. And I was continually changing the idea of what I was going to be when I grew up. And I don't know what I would have done had I known that what I was going to be was an alcoholic when I grew up. And lived the life of an alcoholic. I went to the service, and I was in the Air Force and during the Korean fracas, and I spent all my time in England. I was an air traffic controller, a drunken air traffic controller, make you feel better. And the only battles that I fought was the battles of Piccadilly Circus. And if you'd like to know what those are, I'll explain them to you, but there's a lot of girls involved that wore high heels and raincoats and nothing else. I had a good time. I had a good war, and I drank as frequently as I could. You know, somebody would say to me, "Hey, come on, Dick, let's go get a drink." And I'd say, "May as well, going to get drunk anyway," because that's what I did. Because I drank. I drank to the point of intoxication any time that I possibly could, regardless of what the circumstances were or who had warned me away from it. I came back from the service, and I've always wanted to be married, not because of the example that my parents set, but because I always wanted to have someone to share my life with. Not that I thought my life was so important, but I thought it would be much more fulfilling. And so I was always hunting for a her. And I found several of them over the years. But I was going to college, and I met a young lady and seemed to be attractive to me and seemed to be a decent kid. And her parents were educated, and they're nice people, and we had a couple of kids. I promised her that I'd teach her how to drink if she'd teach me how to dance. She never taught me how to dance, and I never taught her how to drink. But we went along with life as best we could. And our first New Year's Eve, as usual, we were out at a party having a good time. And we kissed at midnight, each other, along with all the others. But as is customary, and with good friends, and I remember kissing her at midnight, and she said to me, "Let's get a divorce." And we have been married 6 months, and I had been faithful to her up to that moment, and from that moment on, I wasn't, because I knew it was inevitable. It was a bad marriage. That's all there was to it. And unfortunately, we had a couple of kids, and they suffered through this and ended up that we got divorced after we'd been married 4.5 years. And about a year and a half later, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And all during the time that after I came home from the war, I was dating the boss's secretary, the big boss, the president of the company, his secretary. And we were not madly in love or anything like that, but I worked for a radio station, and as she did, and we got together and talked about broadcasting and various and sundry other things. And she played golf. Back in those days, even I played golf, and we just had a good time together. Regardless of whether I was married or not, I was going with her at the time that I was courting my wife. After I married my wife, and after we were divorced, and continued going with her. On a Tuesday night, it was like the 13th of September. We'd gone out and gotten very drunk, and she had gotten so drunk I had to carry her to her car so she could drive home. Chivalry wasn't dead, you see. And I was just in terrible shape, and I was living with my widowed mother, and I went back home and passed out, and woke up the next morning, and somehow or another, I don't know what it was that gave me this idea, but I remembered we had made arrangements to meet the Wednesday night, and so we met on Wednesday night, and I told her, I said, you know, I can't drink like we were drinking last night. I said, you know, I was burning hard coal. And so we decided to meet and go to a restaurant, get a bite to eat, and then go to a movie at the Avalon Theater. I don't remember what the movie was, but the movie had changed. It was a new movie, and we didn't want to go see that. And so I said that, well, let's go out to Angler's Inn, which is on the Potomac River. It's a high buck restaurant, very fashionable country inn. And we went out there and had dinner. I don't know what we had for dinner, but I know we had two bottles of wine with dinner. And I'm sure we had a drink afterwards. And we went back to the restaurant where we had started. And it was a sidewalk cafe. And we sat at this sidewalk cafe and drank Remy Martin, Grand Fin, Champagne, Cognac, and coffee. And I don't want to give you the wrong impression. I mean, I don't have any idea how much money I spent that night, but I put it on my American Express card. And I still have an American Express card. I've had one since 65. Which is longer than Robert Redford has had his. I think his is more valuable than mine, however. But as we sat there and talked, and I wasn't drunk, and she wasn't drunk. We both had been drinking, but we were not drunk. And we were sitting there and chatting, and she asked me to marry her. And I had a moment of clarity, the likes of which I haven't had since, I don't believe. And I thought to myself, you know, I can't marry her. I'm already married. And then I thought, you know, and I'm a rotten husband. And I'm a rotten father to my two kids. And I'm a rotten son, and I'm a bad brother, and I'm not a good neighbor and a friend, and I'm a bad employee, and I'm a poor citizen. And I just looked at her, and I said, no, I can't do that. And I called for the bill and paid the bill and left. If I'd have had one more drink, I think we would have probably begun to negotiate on this, because I was in process of getting a divorce. I wasn't divorced yet, but I was in process of getting a divorce. But one of the problems I had was lack of money. And if we'd have begun negotiating, I would have discovered that this gal who drove a Mercedes and had, I knew she had some money outside of her employment, And I would have discovered that she was going to come into the residue of her estate shortly. And she did a couple of years after I got sober. And she inherited $27 million net to her. Now, I got news for you. If I'd have known she had that kind of money coming in, you'd have a different speaker this morning. But I went home and sat on the edge of my bed, and I thought to myself, you know, what is wrong with me? Why can't I be like other people? Jesus Christ, why can't you? What's wrong? And I had been to several psychiatrists. I've been to a couple of doctors, and I saw two ministers and about my drinking, specifically about my drinking. And one doctor told me, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to die drunk, just like your father did, which is true. My father had been nominated for a federal judgeship and went out to celebrate. And when the celebration was going on, he came back home and drunkenly fell down the basement stairs and had a brain hemorrhage and died shortly thereafter. So, you know, the psychiatrist, you know, the last psychiatrist I went to was probably as good an explanation as any. I've been going to him twice a week for a year and a half. Now, that's more intensive psychiatric care than you get in nut houses. And the reason why I went is because I was crazy. Nobody goes to a psychiatrist unless they're crazy. I'm firmly convinced of that. And I went in there and I took a battery of tests. And on this last day I saw him, I said, you know, I came in here and I took this battery of tests. And you never told me the resultant of them. It was a Minneapolis multiphasic personality and ink blots and, you know, the usual personality things. And he said, well, you never asked. And I said, I'm asking now. What was the result? He said, you seem to be preoccupied with sex. I immediately thought I must be some sort of a pervert. And I was. I hope I remember to tell you about that later. But I said, well, when do you think I can get some relief from these life problems? And he said, it took you a long time to get here, didn't it? He said, how old are you? And I said, I'm 33. And he said, which he said a lot. I said, well, doctor, do you think I should go to Alcoholics Anonymous? And he said, no, you're not ready for that yet. And I said, well, regardless of what you believe or what you think is right, I'm not getting any help from this. And I'm not coming anymore. Don't send me a bill for this session because I'm not going to pay it. And I got up and left. 6 months later, I was sitting on the edge of the bed in the sewing room. My mother had a large house, but I got put off in the sewing room because it's a small room and had a single bed in it. Sometimes I'd wake up under the bed. Occasionally someone urinated in that bed. Catch that sumbitch, I'll get him. But it was, my life was, you know, it was really a tatter, and it was really a mess, and I owed all kinds of money, and I didn't have anything. I was near to getting fired. I'd been threatened many times. And as a matter of fact, on that Wednesday, I had my boss had written a memo to the president of the company saying if there was one more alcohol incident, as far as I was concerned, that he was going to fire me, much as he didn't want to do this, but he just couldn't tolerate it anymore. I didn't know that until several weeks after I'd been sober, and my secretary, or his secretary, who was more loyal to me than she was to him, showed me a copy of the memo, and she said, you just barely made it, didn't you? And she was very pleased. Eve was her name, dyed red hair, and she really liked me for some reason. I don't know why, but anyway, she showed me that, and it didn't surprise me at all. But I'd really, boy, I'm telling you, it's seconds and inches. That's all there is to that. And I thought to myself, well, you know, you went to the psychiatrist, you went to doctors, and they wanted to put you in the hospital, and they went to ministers, and you've done everything that you know to do. Nothing has helped. And the only thing I hadn't done is go to AA. And so I made up my mind that that's what I was going to do. And I lay down and I went to sleep, and I got up the next morning and I did not have a drink, which was my custom. Drinking in the morning was, you have to, you can't brush your teeth on an empty stomach, for God's sake. So anyway, I got to work that morning, and I called a minister that had said something to me about going to AA, and I told him I was drinking more and enjoying it less, and I would like to go to AA. And he said, we had a fellow in the parish who was in AA, and he said, I'll have him get in touch with you. And shortly thereafter, Kelly Brown called me and told me that he hadn't been sober long enough to go on a 12-step call, but he would have his sponsor call me. And so I said, okay, whatever that is. And so this fellow called me, and he said, this is Buck Doyle. I'm in AA, and I understand that you want some help. And he and Jim Shaw were just having a great time in, up there in Valhalla, or wherever it is, the big meeting, because they were just alike. They both were short guys and a little overweight, didn't look like they had any necks. Looked like retired Irish cops is what they looked like. But anyway, Bucky said he'd meet me at the corner of Foxhall and Reservoir Roads that night at 7:30 and take me to the meeting. And he did. I cleaned up and went to the meeting, went to the intersection there, and he picked me up. And I didn't live near there, but Kelly Brown did, and he thought that I must be living near there or something. But anyway, he picked me up and took me to my first meeting out on Georgia Avenue in Silver Spring, Maryland. And it was a service meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the area chairman, Ernie the attorney, was explaining the service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he showed a film strip, something like Circles of Love and Service. And I was very interested in it. You know, it was kind of a, gave me a picture of the organization, and, you know, I was a businessman, and so it was of interest to me. And after the meeting was over, we went to a hot shop, and at this hot shop, Buck and Ernie the attorney and No Growth McGee, here was Ernie, he was a practicing attorney, and sober about 5 years. Buck was sober about 12 years, and he was an adding machine salesman. And No Growth McGee was a, he had been shot down during the war. He had been a B-17 pilot, and he spent a lot of time in the German prison camp. And he got out, and he came back to the States and continued his drinking and came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had these three guys sat there, and they 12-stepped me in the traditional sense of the word. They told me what they were like and what had happened and what they're like now. And they told me of things that, you know, it just sounded altogether too familiar to me. It sounded like they were talking about me. And I said, wait a minute. And I said, where'd you guys learn about me? I said, all the stuff that you're talking about that you have done, I have done, and you're just pretending you have done it to hook me in. And they said, no, that isn't it at all, Dick. Those are our experiences. And if you were late, perhaps you may be alcoholic too. And I thought to myself, I'm just exactly like these guys. They've done the same things that I've done. And of course I'm an alcoholic, you know. And it was suggested I go to a meeting every night for 6 weeks and not take a drink a day at a time, and that I read AA literature, and I call Buck on a daily basis and get together, and we would get together the next day, for an example. We got together and went to the AA businessmen's lunch, and a bunch of guys would sit around and eat. We didn't have an AA meeting as such, but we discussed affairs of Alcoholics Anonymous and maybe the frustrations of some of the people that were sponsored and all that sort of thing. Talked about sex and politics and other things we had no understanding of at all. And we just had a great time. Later, in later years, I can remember going in and sitting down, and the ex-chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee was a member, and he was sitting there. The fellow who had been the commander-in-chief of South Pacific during Vietnam was there, and his son is a senator today. And I can remember going there and sitting there, and I was thinking to myself, I'm sitting here with two of the most powerful men in the world. What am I doing with these people? And they were my friends. They were just other members of Alcoholics Anonymous. We shared the same sponsor, and we were brothers in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that cuts through a lot of mud, I'll tell you. But I started doing what I was asked to do. I went to a meeting every night and I met Buck, and Buck was always speaking at the meeting that he told me to go to. There were 63 meetings a week in Washington, D.C. at that time. And in the metro area, and I'm sure that at one time or another, Buck spoke at all of them. There were mostly speaker meetings in those days. There weren't as many discussion meetings as there are today. And I started doing the things which I've learned of are those maintenance things which allowed me to stay sober. The big book says the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not to urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. And it goes on to discuss other things. And it says, it's not easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and let rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. Most people read that and they assume that they're going to have to take some spiritual mantle, and I thought maybe when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous that I was going to have to become a Catholic. I don't know why I thought that, but I did think that. But it's not a question of that at all. It's not a question of how spiritual you are or how spiritual you aren't. It's a question of the maintenance of that spiritual condition. It's a question of taking the steps, taking the actions that keep you sober. It's a question of doing that because it's the maintenance of our spiritual condition that keeps us sober. It's not because we're some wonderful people, because there isn't a person in this room who's wonderful. My wife is nearly wonderful, but I say that in public, but I secretly know a little different. But I started doing the things, started to do those maintenance things. I went to a meeting every day. I called my sponsor every day. I went early to the meetings and helped set up. I stayed late and helped put the chairs up. I certainly, even if I was at a strange meeting, I picked up my chair and someone else's, and I picked up the coffee cups, and I made the place a better place than it had been. I worked very diligently towards doing what my sponsor asked me to do and doing what my sponsor was doing. I did what he did. And he asked, he said, why don't you stop by and pick this guy up and bring him to the meeting? And I'd stop by and pick him up. And that was part of the maintenance of my program. It was part of the maintenance of my program to wake in the morning and say, oh, good morning, God, I'm here. I'll do the best I can. Those thoughts went through my mind. And at night when I went to bed, it was just a simple good night, God. Just a simple good night, God. And very strangely enough, that's exactly what I do yet today. I don't do anything any different than that. I don't have any list of prayers that I do or anything like that. I pray on a daily basis, just simple. Pray for the knowledge of His will and the power to carry it out. That's all. And I'm not sure that I know His will beyond staying sober and helping other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. There's nothing else. There's nothing secret or mystical about this, except the fact that in doing those simple things, by going to the meeting, by being where I'm supposed to be when I'm supposed to be there, do what I say I'm going to do when I say I'm going to do it, it's those things. It's exercising as much integrity as I possibly can on a daily basis. It's doing those things which allow me to be sober, which allow me to stay sober one day at a time. My sponsor at the time, Buck, told me, he said, you know, I don't think people stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous unless they make a commitment, and they have to make a commitment to themselves and therefore to God, that they're going to stay sober until they die. And that sounds like a bit of an exaggeration, perhaps, but it's not an exaggeration at all, because we're taught in Alcoholics Anonymous to live our lives a day at a time, and you don't take a drink one day at a time. If you just don't take that drink, you're going to stay sober. And if you go to meetings on a regular basis, I still go to at least 4 meetings a week, sometimes 5, sometimes 7. It really varies according to which week it is. But I'm still very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I sponsor a lot of guys. And these guys stay sober. And it isn't because of me. It's because of what God asks us to do. God asks us to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And a day at a time, I help the guys that I sponsor to stay sober. And a day at a time, they help me to stay sober. That's why it feels so good to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why if you're an alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic, the best place for us to be is in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because in there, we're not worried about anything. We're not concerned about anything except the new guy that comes in or the fellow that's been having problems, and giving him a pat on the back and wishing him well and hoping that they're coming along well. And how did that turn out? How did this action work for you? We sponsors give these newcomers actions to take, and they take them, and if it works for them, we try them out ourselves. Really, really simple. And we learn from that. We learn from the example of other people whether things work or don't work. We're actually a very large group of very judgmental people. We get very judgmental. And that's not necessarily a negative thing. It can be a very positive thing. We judge other people on how they're doing and how they're staying sober. And if they're doing this and they're not staying sober, well, I'll stay away from that action. You know, I'd rather do what this guy's doing. He's been sober longer than I have, and he's staying sober, and he's taking these actions. He's doing what he's supposed to do when he's supposed to do it. So I take those actions. Aside from the basics of the 12 steps, admitting we're powerless over alcohol and that our lives have become unmanageable, realizing that AA can help us stay sober, doing what AA wants us to do, like write a fourth step and talk to someone else about that, and realizing we don't want to be that way anymore. And there's not much we can do about it, except maybe if we just do the right thing. And we, as we do the right thing on a continued basis, with no particular intent involved, no negotiation involved, just go to work on time and work while you're there. That's a novel thing for an alcoholic to do. And just doing those things is an end result. What happens is we stay sober. And we realize we have hurt people. We've harmed people, and we make amends to them, not to make them feel better, but to make us feel better, and to discharge our responsibilities, and to act like we're supposed to act, and do the things that we're supposed to do, like stop at stop signs. Don't slide through them. When the light is yellow, you put your foot on the brake and stop, because it's going to turn red. You know, you try to obey the laws of man, nature, and God to the best of your ability. And as an end result of doing that, we get progressively better. We don't get perfect. In chapter 5, it says we're not saints. We're not. We're not even trying to be saints. We're just trying to be a little better than we were yesterday. A little better than we were last year, or last month, or last week. A little better than we were earlier this morning, maybe. Just a day at a time, just trying to be a decent person. You know, getting an education is very important. That we do that so that we can be more comfortable, because we like creature comforts, and there's nothing wrong with having creature comforts. There's nothing wrong with somebody coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and making a good living. As a matter of fact, there's everything right about that. That's the right thing to do. We make those amends. I had various experiences of that, just like you have. But most of all, some days, the best we can do is just not take that first drink. Some days, we just make them crappy days. Crappy days don't occur. We make them that way. We cause them to happen. And we try to do the best we can. We make our amends. We take our inventory on a daily basis and make amends to those people that we have harmed and tell them we were wrong and move on from there. God, I just love that step. You know, we talk about being wrong. We don't talk about being sorry. Being sorry is a condition of self-deprecation. It's a condition of thinking less of yourself than you really are, because you're really one of God's kids, just like I am. And God wishes the same thing for you that He wishes for me. He wishes a good life, and He wishes for sobriety and comfort and serenity and happiness. And He wishes that to everyone. The Bible says something about God's grace. It's like the rain that falls on the just and unjust alike. Everybody gets their share. I learned to do those things to the best of my ability. When I was newly sober, the first few weeks I was sober, I started asking Buck questions, and I asked him, I said, Buck, I said, I was going to the psychiatrist, and I asked him if I should go to AA. You'll notice I'm reversing the order, and I did that on purpose. I just wanted to know whether I should trust him or not. And I said, He said, no, I wasn't ready for that. I said, what did he mean? And he said, he just meant you still had money. And that was such a cynical, sardonic answer. I loved it. And so I figured I could trust him on something else. And I said, well, what does AA say about recovery? What do they say about getting well? The psychiatrist said, you know, I was 33 and it took me a long time to get there. And I said, what does AA say about that? And he says, generally in AA we say if you stay sober for 1 month, for each year that you drank, and you add about a dozen months to that if you smoke those little cigarettes with no names and so on. And I'd been drinking for 19 years. And so that was 19 months. And I occasionally took something I shouldn't have, like my wife's diet pills. I was tired. They pep me up. What am I going to say? The psychiatrist gave me an open-ended prescription for Valium. I would take as many as 20 milligram capsules of Valium a day. That would kill me today. It would give me kidney failure. But I was so overdosed with alcohol, it just didn't seem to have much effect. It just made me a dumb, slow-thinking alcoholic is what it made me. But I liked his answers. So I said, you know, when I was taking a test, and he said that I was, you know, seemed to be preoccupied with sex. And I said, what do you think about that? And he said, well, Dick, he said, you know, if you take alcohol and remove the water, what you have is a substance much like ether. And he said, that'll anesthetize even the smaller parts of your body. Now, he hadn't seen me in a shower, you know. Where was he coming, by the way? His answers to my problems were so simple, and they were so easy. You know, just go to a meeting, Dick. You'll be all right. Things are a little tough. Go to an extra meeting this week. Or why don't you just get back to going to a meeting every night? Try that until you feel better. And you feel better, and you drop back down to your 4 meetings a week or whatever it is. And so I did that. And he says, always help others, because sponsorship is the key. What you do to help someone else helps you. You've got to give it away to keep it. And sometimes I don't want to give it away. Some days I just want to keep it all to myself and screw them. Some days they're just not good days. I've screwed them up somehow. I'm worried about my condition, whatever that might be that day. But if I just go ahead, you know, sometimes I don't know whether you've ever been in this condition or not, but some days it's, you know, along about 7 o'clock at night, it's just, come on, midnight. You know, just can I go lie down somewhere and go to sleep? Because I know it'll be better tomorrow, no matter what it is. Just come on, midnight. It's so good to be able to be with people who want to do what you do. It's so good to be with people who want sobriety on an all-time basis. It's good to be with people who want to stay sober for the rest of their lives. It's good to be with people who spread that around and carry that message. That it, indeed it's the maintenance of your spiritual condition that keeps you there. It's taking the actions one day at a time, just doing those things you're in front of you to do. You shake hands with the speaker, regardless of whether they've made a good talk or not. It doesn't make any difference. Sometimes you go up and shake hands and say thank you. But I don't have a bad a talk as you do. Sometimes, you know, sometimes we just take the actions. We act differently. We act better than we feel. And when you take that action, what happens is that you end up feeling better. gradually you end up feeling better. If you just take those actions, you gradually feel better, and you feel like it's okay. It's okay to be me. I went to a meeting at the Friendship Group in Washington Cathedral in the fall of 65. And there was a little gal there who was the secretary of the group. And she was reading the messages and announcements and dropping half of them on the floor and giggling. And it was perfectly obvious that she needed a keeper. And I set my sights on her. And she wouldn't have anything to do with me. She wouldn't go out with me. I asked her out several times, and she wouldn't go out with me. And I don't handle rejection very well. I don't know about you, but I told my sponsor about it. I said, I'd really like to date her. And he said, well, you just keep going. You just stay sober, and you become the best AA member you can, and just see what happens. And so I did. I did what he told me to do. And I was in a group meeting. Went there to pick up some tickets for the intergroup banquet that was held that spring to sell in a group. And she was there picking them up for her group. And afterwards, we went and had a cup of coffee and chatted for a while. And I said, well, would you like to go to the intergroup banquet with me? And in those days, it was quite the affair. The men would wear tuxedos, and the women wore long dresses. And if you took someone, you bought her a flower. You know, it was just like high school prom, I suppose. And she said, no. She said, I'm one of the hostesses. I won't have time. Damn, foiled again. And so I went to the intergroup banquet anyway, got there, and she was standing around by herself. She wasn't being a hostess to anything, really. She had suspected that she was going to be busy doing guiding people or doing something, I asked her for a date. And she said, well, give me a call at the office tomorrow or Monday. And I said, okay. I called her up, and she said, my schedule's so busy, I just have so many things to do. And she said the first time that she had available was on June the 6th. June the 6th, 1966. I was married before on June the 6th. D-Day was June the 6th. It didn't sound like it was good to me. Besides that, it was a Monday night. Now, date night is Friday night or Saturday night. You know, it's not Monday night. But I was anxious, so I said, that'll be great. And I said, I'll get a couple of tickets for pre-Broadway production of Barefoot in the Park at the National Theater. We can go out to dinner first. And we went out to dinner at a seafood restaurant, and I remember she ordered shrimp salad. I said, you can order something else, you know, get lobster or whatever. I like shrimp salad. Okay. And so we had a nice dinner and had a pleasant time. She laughed. I wasn't much into laughing in these days, but we went on to the theater and saw this comedy and laughed and had a great time and enjoyed it. And I'd taken her back home, and I had that afternoon. I had a 1964 Ford Falcon with bourbon bumps all over it, and someone had urinated in the front seat. The driver's side. I don't know who that was. But I was driving down George Avenue, and there was a Pontiac dealership over here on the right-hand side, and there was a gold Bonneville convertible sitting in the window. And I drove into the shop, and I said, I want that car. And I bought that car, and I took her out for a date, and she was very impressed. Wasn't anything grandiose about me at all. I think passed everything except a gas station. But we had a great time. And I said, well, what are you doing tomorrow night? And she said, well, I'm not doing anything. And I said, well, you know, I'll drop by and pick you up. We'll get a bite to eat and go to a meeting. She said, that'll be fine. So we did that. What are you doing Wednesday night? Well, I'm going to the friendship group. Well, I'll meet you. We'll get a cup of coffee afterwards. Oh, that'll be wonderful. What are you doing? Well, Thursday was a regular meeting that I attended, so we went there. Friday night was back to the friendship group. Saturday night it was the Annandale group. We went out every night. Her schedule just seemed to open up. I don't know what happened. But God, she was going to have a boring week or two there, I can tell you. But we started dating, and I can remember one time we were going somewhere, and I can't remember where it was, but I kept telling her that I loved her, and she'd say, oh, that's nice, and things like that. And I was driving, I remember the spot. We have driven by it many times since, and I told her I loved her, and she said, well, I love you too. And I stopped the car, and I got out of the car and ran around the car two or three times saying, she loves me, she loves me. It wasn't long after that that I was over at her apartment, and she asked me to marry her. And I readily accepted the proposal. And we started talking about when we should get married. And she said, well, I said, well, you know, we should get married in Bellevue, because her dad was a sack surgeon general at that time. And it's customary to get married at your parents', at the girl's parents' home or so on. And she said, no, that's too far away. And I said, well, let's do it in October. I get my commission check. And she said, well, this isn't about money. And I said, why don't we wait until Buck gets back? He's on vacation. He'll be back shortly. He was speaking at an AA conference that night. I'd made a promise to him that I wouldn't take any extraordinary measures in my life without discussing it with him first. And so I called, and I found out where he was, and I caught him in his hotel room, and I said, you know, Buck, I'm thinking about getting married. He said, who are you thinking about marrying, that Peggy girl? And I said, yeah. And he said, that's okay. He says, she's been sober longer than you have. Boy, I tell you, that was the worst piece of advice he ever gave me. Ever since that, it's been, well, when you've been sober as long as I have, dear. I'm telling you guys right now, don't marry some gal that's been sober longer than you have. It will be your downfall. Just a terrible thing to do. Peg and I have a son. He married a gal that's been sober longer than he has. He and I get together and commiserate on it every now and then. Just a terrible, and I said, well, I warned you. Nobody warned me. But we got married. We went to meetings every night, and we continued to be very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. We continued to love each other more and more as time went on. And we had a son, Jim. Jim's been sober 17 years in Alcoholics Anonymous now. We lived through all of his drinking crap. And dope and whatever. But he's sober and active in AA. And his wife is sober and active in AA. And, they have two kids. They got little Joe. And little Joe's 11. And Peg told you about Caitlin shopping at Von Maur. It's not good. we're very active in AA in our home, and our the phone's always ringing. We like to get away for weekends like this so we don't have to answer phones. It's really nice. But I look forward to being home tomorrow morning at 7:15. Al from Richmond's going to call. And I got a call from John on Tuesday morning at 8, and so on and so forth. And many people in between there. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about for me and for my wife. She talked about her father dying and difficulties in the past couple of years. We'd take them out to eat and we'd have them come over to the house. And we'd go over and take food over to their house and take them to the doctors and take them to the dentist and take them to wherever they needed to go to be cared for. And it added a dimension to our lives, not in place of AA by any stretch of the imagination, because if we hadn't been going to AA, we couldn't have done those things. And I was very pleased to be able to do that. My father-in-law, I asked him early on, I said, you know, I would feel most uncomfortable calling you general. I certainly would introduce you as that, or doctor. And I certainly wouldn't call you by your first name out of respect. I said, my father is dead. May I call you dad? And he said, yes. And I respected him as that 39 years. He was a good man. And he was a good breeder, I'll tell you that. And so much for AA. So much for my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had a fabulous life in AA. I've gone all kinds of places that I never dreamed that I would. I've been with all kinds of people. I have friends that I've had for just years and years and years and years and years. One of the fellows that I sponsored originally in Bellevue celebrated 30 years the other day. And he and I have been firm friends and compatriots, and we've done things in Alcoholics Anonymous together. And another fellow's coming up with 30 years on August the 5th. Another guy's coming up with 30 years on August the 24th. Another guy's coming up with 30 years in October. And I've had two others that have had 30 years already this year. And I've known these guys for a long time, ever since their birth in Alcoholics Anonymous. What a great life it is. Many years ago, John Scott, sponsor, was failing to live up to the example that John expected, at least. And John called me up and asked me about sponsorship. And I suggested that he get Jim Shaw to sponsor him because Vinoy was sponsoring his wife. And man and wife teams are fine as long as we don't discuss their cases. I don't discuss John's case with Peggy, or I don't have anything to do in sponsorship with Cindy. But if Peggy sponsored her, for an example, she wouldn't tell me what's going on with her. We just don't talk about the people we sponsor amongst each other that way because we believe there's a great deal of privacy involved. And but we're very busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we love the people that we sponsor and love the people that we're with. I don't know what kind of a point I was trying to make to that, but what I'm really trying to say is thank you. Thanks for having us. I certainly hope that I've said something today that was helpful to you or be helpful to you in the future. It reminds me that I'm supposed to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. That's what my life is about. And I need reminded about that just like anyone else does. And it's great to be here. And it's great to be at the opening of the first the first conference, the first time. It's a good shot. I think that Paha Sapa is supposed to mean Black Hills, but I have a sinking suspicion that it's an Indian word for screw the white man. I'm not sure of that, but I think that's a possibility. But anyway, it was a great title, and you all have done a great job with it. Wayne's done great. It was nice to see so many friends here, so many people that I've met in AA and met in this area and other areas. And it's just great to be here and great to be a member of AA. Thank you. I'm not going to stand down to shake hands because I'm going to go over there and get the materials ready for those people who wish them and who've ordered them. So I accept your well wishes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Grandpa Dick. That was awesome. What a fine example to follow.